It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there's free fishing on many lakes in the state this weekend. An ice fishing expert will give us some advice and encouragement to give it a try.
First, the lawsuit filed by 17 states to block President Obama's immigration plan is being heard today in Texas. Texas is leading the suit, and 16 other Republican-controlled states have signed on as well, including Wisconsin.
The states involved say that the president is violating his constitutional duty to enforce the laws and is illegally placing new burdens on state budgets.
This week, a dozen other states filed a brief supporting the president's immigration plan, saying that the plan keeps families together and helps their economies. Here with us to talk about the case is political science professor Howard Schwaber of UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, which parts of the president's plan are being challenged?
Well, that gets a little complicated. There are two distinct parts to the president's executive order or his plan here, and then there's actually a third issue. So the two parts of the plan are first to refrain from deporting Dreamers and other illegal immigrants who fall into specific categories. The president was very careful to make sure that people who have been convicted of crimes, for example, are still subject to deportation, but he used his claim of executive discretion to declare that a very large number, several million, up to 4.7 million illegal immigrants, would not be subject to deportation. Second, the president's plan also extends certain benefits to these illegal immigrants, and that's a separate item with separate constitutional issues. And those are the two parts of the plan. The third issue that's being raised by the states is that, in practice, the consequence of this plan is to impose new costs on state governments, which are obliged to provide certain or continue providing certain benefits, and that is independently a constitutional issue.
In terms of precedents, are there other precedents of states challenging executive actions like this?
There are, and really the three pieces that I just described each fall into a separate, pretty well-established, although not necessarily clear, constitutional category. So the first one is in some ways the easiest. Does the president have the authority to order Homeland Security to refrain from deporting a certain category of people? And the obvious answer is yes. Obvious in the sense that there's a lot of precedent that says the executive branch has almost unfettered discretion in determining how to enforce the law. And even whether to enforce the law, at least on a case-by-case basis. Now, the states filing this lawsuit claim that this is an unusual situation because this isn't an exercise of executive discretion on a case-by-case basis. It's on a broad, categorical kind of basis. But that's not really a sharp distinction. There are also at least three other legal theories that would support the president's action as far as suspension of deportation goes. One is that the law explicitly gives the executive branch the authority to set priorities, and that seems to support, you know, even a broader grant of executive discretion. Secondly, there's a lot of precedent for the idea of de facto delegation of authority, that is, Congress has acquiesced in the past to executive exercising this kind of discretion. And third, the Congress has consistently funded these enforcement efforts at such a low level that the executive branch has had no choice but to make priority decisions. And there's only funding to proceed with deportation proceedings against a small fraction of the total, then by definition some choices are going to have to be made as to what groups will or will not be targeted. So the Obama administration is probably on its strongest constitutional ground, certainly based on existing precedent, in the decision not to deport. But it gets a little trickier when you get to the question of extending benefits. And that brings us to a really interesting case from way back in 1973 that no one's talking about, but really we should be talking about. So way back in 1973, under the Nixon administration, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare systematically refrained from enforcing the Civil Rights Act. They were under federal law, HEW was not supposed to allow schools that were not desegregating to receive federal funds, but quite systematically, they were deliberately sending federal funds to segregated schools despite complete noncompliance. And when that was brought to the attention of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that court sitting en banc, that is all the judges from the whole circuit, got together and wrote a pretty stinging opinion that says this goes way beyond executive discretion. This is the executive deliberately undermining Congress's purposes refusing to carry out the policy. And furthermore, this, they said, is different from an ordinary instance of executive discretion because the government is affirmatively giving money and benefits to these people. So there's a kind of an interesting and ironic parallel here. that the one case, at least that I'm aware of, that strongly stands for the proposition that there are limits to executive discretion when the exercise of that discretion would undermine Congress's purposes, and that those limits kick in with special force when the government is not only failing to punish people or deport them or imprison them or whatever, but is actually providing benefits. The one case that really strengthens those two arguments is, ironically, a case brought on behalf of racial minorities challenging the Nixon administration's refusal to enforce desegregation laws.
So there's a lot to look at there. Maybe that first case you talked about will come up as this case progresses. Let's look at the third point there, that the executive action is imposing new costs to the state. How does that fare in court?
That one is quite weak. There are circumstances in which the federal government imposing costs on the states can become a problem. And the most obvious is what we call unfunded mandates. So if Congress passes a law saying all states must provide, I don't know, a free car to every citizen, but won't provide any federal dollars to carry out that goal, that's an unfunded mandate. And there are limits on how Congress can do that. And there are also limits on the ways in which Congress can use the states to carry out federal law. Now, you notice I keep saying Congress. Here we have the odd situation where the burden on the states is by an executive order issued by the president, not by an act of Congress at all. There really, though, isn't much precedent for the idea that the fact that a federal action, regardless of which branch is acting, has the effect of creating some circumstance that's going to cost the states money. There's not really much precedent for the idea that that mere effect raises a constitutional issue. After all, there are all kinds of contexts in which the states have to expend money. And as I pointed out earlier, Congress has not allocated nearly enough money to deport all illegal aliens. So by definition, Congress has left the states carrying some of those costs.
Well, speaking of costs, when you've got a multi-state lawsuit like this against the federal government from the states, who's paying for it?
The taxpayers. And this is likely to become quite expensive. I'm quite sure this will cost millions of dollars before it's over. I should point out that in all the comments I've made so far are based on the precedents that are already on the books. The U.S. Supreme Court can always, once this case reaches them, make a new rule. And this is sometimes how new rules happen. So there's a long-standing precedent for executive discretion, but perhaps this exercise of executive discretion looks different from the others, bigger, more sweeping, more clearly contrary to the will of Congress. And this could be one of those cases that produces a new rule and a new defining principle. As things stand right now, though, the decision to refrain from deporting and the incidental imposition of costs, those are pretty weak claims. But the decision to extend benefits, that might have some teeth.
As we look ahead about how this might progress, do you think it's likely that this could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's almost certain to do so, because obviously no matter which side loses, they're going to appeal. And this is the kind of question about the relations between the branches of government that the Supreme Court really exists to resolve. I mean that both sort of historically and philosophically. The idea of separation of powers is in part that one branch can act as a referee when the other two are at loggerheads. And here you have a direct conflict over the question, what are the limits the Constitution imposes on the sharing or distribution of powers between the branches? And that's an area in which the Supreme Court has always asserted its supremacy and its sole authority to make final determinations.
Now, the first part of this case is being heard in Texas. Do you have any indication about how the judge there could rule?
Yeah, there is some indication that the judge in question is quite conservative. He's a Republican appointee, and the expectation is that he might very well rule against the Obama administration, if only to make a point. Again, in this first round of litigation, everyone involved, including the judge, knows full well that there's going to be more. It's going to go on to at least a court of appeals. And so there's a certain amount of posturing going on. It will be interesting to see what legal arguments the judge relies on and how far he's willing to go in terms of pushing the principles. But as I say, there is at least an arguable precedent out there for the idea that while executive discretion is a privilege of the executive branch, it may reach a limit when it's directly undermining the purposes of Congress. That was true in 1973. It's not impossible that courts will find that is true again today.
And in terms of Wisconsin and Wisconsin's stake in this, what does the Walker administration feel is at stake for Wisconsin?
That's a good question. I think to a very large extent, the Walker administration is really just trying to position, Scott Walker is trying to position himself politically. He wants to be, we all suspect that he wants to run for president. Whether that's true or not, within the Republican Party, he wants to position himself appropriately on the question of immigration, which is one of the defining issues for the Republican Party at this time. Wisconsin does have some direct financial stake here. There are undocumented aliens in Wisconsin, but surely not nearly as many as in states like Texas and Arizona and Louisiana or even Missouri.
Well, Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
We've been speaking with political science professor Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison about the lawsuit against the president's immigration plan being heard today in Texas. It was filed by 17 states, including Wisconsin. First, if you've ever thought about giving ice fishing a try, this might be the weekend to do it. The state DNR has a free fishing weekend going on, no license required, and there are fishing events going on all around the state. You can get more information on the DNR website.
Ray Spitz joins us now. He's a longtime angler here in Wisconsin. Ray, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you again, Rob. Thank you.
Well, tell us about this free fishing weekend the DNR has going on.
Well, here's the bottom line. The State Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, it's going to offer its third annual free fishing winter weekend later this month. By the way, they have one in the open water season as well, and I don't believe any other state does this, although I'm not 100% sure. Now, anglers can fish without a license or Great Lakes salmon stamp on all Wisconsin waters on Saturday and Sunday, January 17th and 18th. And believe it or not, the DNR will loan equipment out at 19 sites around the state, including 8 state parks. And if folks want to find out about that opportunity to get equipment to ice fish, they can go to dnr.wi.gov. That's on the web. Or they can call toll-free at 888-936-7463. And the only other thing that you have to do is bundle up warm. It's going to be nice temperatures and go out ice fishing and then look forward to the Packers taking down the Seahawks. So that'll be a great weekend.
And let's get into the basics of some of this. I suppose that the DNR wants to get new people out there trying the sport of ice fishing. So for people who might be put off by, you know, all the equipment and how do you stay warm on the ice and all of that, what are some of the basics? What do we need to know before we hit the ice?
Fair enough. First of all, as I tell people, if you're going to equip yourself with all the stuff you need for ice fishing, it can run into a lot of money. You need an ice auger to drill holes through the ice. You can use a sled or an ATV or a snowmobile to get out. There's all kinds of shelters that you can put up. But simply put, I always tell people, you must know somebody. There are 15,000 lakes in Wisconsin. And you must know somebody who has a friend or a friend of a friend who can perhaps take you along with your kids. It isn't only the fishing. Of course, you can see things like deer and eagles. And this weekend, with the weather warming up, it's going to be fantastic. The best suggestion, though, is to don't be a fashionista, dress warm. And by that, I mean particularly your extremities, your hands and your feet will and often can get cold to the point of hypothermia, and that goes for your face as well. So it's best to make sure that you layer yourself with clothing that can wick away perspiration, and make sure that you're in an area, of course, that is safe. There's an old adage in the fishing guide situation in which they say there is no such thing as safe ice. But of course there is. But ice can be very iffy all over. For instance, up in Eagle River, they have 6 to 14 inches of ice, and yet guides tell me that they would not take a truck out on the ice. So, I mean, the best thing I can tell you is know someone who is familiar with the area you want to fish. Go with them. Or if you don't have any friend, take a look on any lake in your area. And as I said, there are 15,000 lakes in our wonderful state, and you're going to see groups of anglers in certain areas, and those are normally safe to go out on.
Now, Ray, why do you love ice fishing?
I guess the best way, people ask me that all the time, the best answer I can give is I love the sounds of silence. And really out there, the only thing you hear is a clinking of a can or a hot cup of coffee or somebody saying flag up, which means that they've got a walleye or a northern. And the kids, of course, just love running around and seeing all the wilderness that this state has to offer all over, from north to south, from east to west. It's unfailingly beautiful, and that's the truth. It's unique.
Well, it sounds lovely, but I want to go back to the ice part of it. You said it has to be, you have to be safe. You have to be on safe ice. How do you determine whether you've got the right amount of ice? Is there a way that you can get a feel for what's safe or a way that you can measure it? How do you do it?
Okay. There are a number of things. As I said, first of all, if you go out on a lake and you see 30 or 40 shacks or shelters or people sitting on big white 5-gallon cans, you can pretty well sure that that's a safe area. The other thing I would surely suggest is just go to a bait shop. They're all over everywhere in every single part of the state, and find out what's safe, where it's safe, and what the ice thickness is. In other words, some people say that you can go out on ice in 3 inches, some say 5 inches, that is walking. Then you need more for a snowmobile. You need more, far more yet for a truck. Every single year, no matter how much the DNR, and by the way, they run classes on this, there are going to be people who go through the ice with a snowmobile, an ATV, and a truck or an automobile. And I'm sad to say that at times there can be tragic results.
Well, on the happier side, Ray, what you mentioned walleye, some others. What kind of fish are we catching when we go ice fishing?
Okay, all right. First of all, you're catching and you catch a lot of these panfish like bluegill, pumpkin seed, you know, sunfish, yellow perch, white and black crappie, and you can catch northern pike, the great northern pike, and the treasure of everyone, the walleye. Or a sauger. I have never caught a sauger in Wisconsin, but that's part of the perch family, and they're available as well. And they, each of them make wonderful, wonderful meals in a frying pan or even out on the ice. They have a fish fry right on the ice with a portable propane heater.
Yeah, I read about that. So people catch the fish, and you eat it right then on the ice? Is that common?
That is absolutely true. And the nice thing is that the what you don't eat, you know, the innards or the what you don't fillet, believe me, there'll be an eagle or an osprey running down to get them. And that happens all the time, by the way.
How do you prepare it?
I'm so sorry, I didn't hear you.
How do you prepare that fish that you're eating on the ice?
All right, you just have a frying pan. You bring out, I always use clarified butter, what they call in the Indian cuisine, ghee, G-H-E-E. It doesn't smoke. It has none of the bad trans fats, and you just bring in a little flour and some butter, salt and pepper, and you just fry them up, maybe a couple of minutes on each side, and there is a meal. You can bring along salads and things like that, but the main thing is the joy of eating the fish. There's just nothing like it. And anyone from Wisconsin or who has ever fished in Wisconsin will tell you, as they're shaking their head yes and smacking their lips, they'd love one of those right now.
Ray, you and I have talked about this. We both love walleye. How does our Wisconsin fish stack up to, you know, the ocean fish that people out on the coast are eating all the time?
I'm glad you asked that. I like ocean fish. I mean, fish are good. Tuna, grouper, Chilean sea bass, if you can still find them. But people don't seem to realize, if you read all the cooking recipes from the large sites and the magazines, they all talk about the ocean fish. And anyone that has ever had a freshwater fish fry will tell you they'll never go back. And that's the truth. It really is a very special opportunity. We have a unique and wonderful state, and I want people to know that and how much fun and enjoyment anyone and everyone can have by going out, particularly this weekend, where it doesn't cost you anything. Just get some bait, maybe you can get a couple little pieces of equipment. Someone will drill a hole for you in the ice, and you're all good to go.
Is the ice fishing community in Wisconsin as a whole, is it pretty friendly? So if you're a newbie, you go out there, you've got some questions, other folks on the ice might help you out?
Wonderful question. I can only say is that, as usual, Wisconsinites are extremely friendly and helpful. And they will go out of their way to assist you, particularly if you tell them, I haven't done this before. Many will just say, well, come on and fish in this hole and let's sit down and talk about it. And especially with kids, people, the answer to your question is an emphatic yes. They're very friendly and helpful.
And Ray, will you be out on the ice this weekend?
No, I won't.
I've been out
once already this year, and had a great time, and I'll probably be going out again, but not this weekend. I'll give everyone else a chance to do it.
Do you have a favorite fishing hole for ice fishing?
I will say this because people always ask me that. Believe me, there are fishing holes, if you want to call them that, all over the state. I particularly like to go to Eagle River. They've got 1,300 glacial lakes right in the area. And they've got great people up there, and they're always willing to help you. Great community, and the fishing is fantastic. It really is.
Great.
But
well,
there are also great fishing in all other areas of the state. I'm just saying the one that I use and the one I go up, because I have friends up there and guides I know up there, is Eagle River.
Great. Ray, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us today.
It was a pleasure, and I'm glad that we had a chance to talk today.
That was longtime fisherman Ray Spitz talking about ice fishing and this weekend's free fishing event. Wisconsin's lawmakers are gearing up for a debate over the state's next budget. Agencies have submitted their requests, and Governor Walker will announce his budget priorities at the beginning of next month. As it stands, the state has a $2.2 billion projected deficit.
Many lawmakers, particularly Republicans, say that number is based on wish lists from departments and that some parts of government won't get the increases in funding they've asked for. Critics, mostly Democrats, say the projected deficit could mean serious funding cuts for programs that have already seen their funding go down.
The coming debate will focus heavily on things like money for education and roads, promised property tax cuts, and agency consolidation.
Here to talk about how our lawmakers might address these questions is Representative John Nygren from Marinette. He's co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee. Representative Nygren, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back.
So a year ago this week, looking back at old headlines, Wisconsin was projecting a nearly $1 billion surplus for that budget cycle. We're now talking about a projected deficit of $2.2 billion. Why the difference?
Well, one of the biggest changes, first of all, our economy has grown at the rate that was expected, and there's a good explanation for that. But we're also in the same boat as I was at a national conference of state legislators recently. 38 other states are seeing their revenues not grow at the expected rate. The national economy has not taken off as expected. In addition to that, the changes due to the at the federal level, capital gains changes, the income for the states has been lower than anticipated. Actually, compared to some of my colleagues in other states, we're actually in a much better position here in Wisconsin.
So $2.2 billion short of what departments are asking for. Are we going to need serious cuts, serious decisions to cut what the state does?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned in the lead-in, the wish list. Some of those things that will not end up in the final budget. That there's no doubt about it. Even, you know, I would point out this has been a big argument between Republicans and Democrats throughout time. I'm don't believe we're going to be in a situation where actually we spend less at the end of this budget than we did in the past. I actually just don't believe that it's going to grow at the rate maybe some on the other side of the aisle might want it to.
Now, we're seeing some positive signs in the national economy, a big third quarter GDP growth last year. Is Wisconsin not keeping pace with that? Is that part of why we're not seeing revenue keep up?
No, I think what you're going to see is you're going to actually see, I do expect, I was talking to the Revenue Secretary the other evening following the governor's State of the State address. I actually do believe when we get to later this year, you're going to see the impacts of the fairly decent year in the market come into play. And I'm hopeful that we're going to see revenue estimates that are much more optimistic come April, May of this year.
We're going to spend a lot.
Those numbers you're talking about are not being calculated into the projections at this point in time.
We're going to spend a lot of time on the spending side. I want to stay with revenue for a moment. Governor Walker in his campaign said he wanted to cut taxes. He has said since being reelected he wants to cut property taxes. But over $2 billion short of what departments are asking for, is this the time to cut taxes, cut revenue when we've got this spending shortfall?
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. And the governor and I, and I think most Republicans are in a position where we believe that government should be a reflection of the of the state of Wisconsin and the desire of the people of the state of Wisconsin. And actually, there was just a recent a poll came out there a couple days ago that said that almost 2-1 citizens in Wisconsin favor lower taxes, even if that meant a reduction in services. So I actually believe we can maintain the level of services and at the same time still control taxes and even in fact reduce them as we have in past budgets.
On the spending side, big picture, a lot of things in the budget don't have a lot of wiggle room. Things like Medicaid, that's a big piece. Yep. Transportation, lawmakers said they don't want to cut that, not too much. So whose wish lists among the departments are a priority? Whose aren't?
Well, I mean, I think the governor is going to put his plan in place. And then, of course, we as a legislature have our own kick at the cat and our responsibility to present a budget. I actually do think you're going to see some reforms as the governor's already proposed. I do believe that, you know, transportation funding, as you mentioned, that is an issue that I believe that we need to address the revenues, and I'm willing to look at options to address those revenues, because as cars are becoming more fuel efficient, we are seeing a declining revenue source. At the same time, of course, you know, it's not getting any cheaper to build our highways and maintain our bridges. So I'm willing to have that discussion. So I think that at the end of the day, we're going to have a budget that's balanced. I do look for tax cuts that are within our means to necessarily put us in a difficult position. 2 years from now, we're going to be talking about significant surpluses rather than a tight budget.
Well, let's dig into some specifics. Let's keep rolling down that transportation road. We've been hearing lately, you know, last fall, the state transportation secretary thought, hey, maybe some tax increases. Gas tax hike last November seems like support for that has slowly but surely fizzled, or if it was ever there. So if we don't raise gas taxes, where, as co-chair of Joint Finance, do you see the money coming from to maintain the level of spending we have on our roads?
Well, I think every line item has to be looked at in Department of Transportation or in any state agency. As you have seen, the governor is proposing consolidations and reforms. If there's opportunities for us to do that within transportation and save dollars, we should do that. Transportation should not be, untouchable department. If there's dollars that can be saved, we should find them. But at the same time, as I said, I'm willing to find new revenues to be able to fund. I'd like to see this situation. We've been talking about transportation funding for quite some time. I'd like to be able to find a solution once and for all. We'll see what the governor has to say, but we're going to have our kick at the cat as well.
So new revenues, there's not a lot of warmth for a gas tax increase. There's been talk of new sales taxes or pulling some auto-related taxes out of the general revenue part of the budget and earmarking it for transportation. Do you see money being taken out of the general budget to shore up transportation?
I mean, I think that's been discussed in the past. The dollars, you know, for automobile purchases, et cetera. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that, you know, those are obviously transportation related. The speaker and even myself, I've been supportive of, I've been looking for things that are user fees. People that are using the road should be helping to fund them and paying their fair share, whether that be, tolling, which has been implemented in many other states throughout the country, true user tax, or whether that be a mileage-based system. We're going to take a look at all of those.
Let's turn to another complicated part of the budget, the education funding. The Department of Public Instruction has asked for an increase in funding of $613 million. It comes after a billion-plus cut to education. I know people have spun that change differently, depending on who you talk to. Do you think we'll see an increase in education funding in this budget cycle?
Well, I mean, you're right. I guess it depends on who you talk to, whether that's actually been $1 billion in cut. I mean, you use the term cut, but I would point out that we've been able to give more tools so the dollars that we spend in education actually go into the classroom. And I would suggest that the level of spending in the classroom is higher now than it was when the governor took office 4 years ago. Perhaps maybe some other areas that had seen spending in education are a little bit more lean than they were, and I think that taxpayers would agree with that. But I think we're going to continue to look for those avenues. The $613 million in education, at least in my eight years now, going on 10 in the legislature, that's a record ask. I don't expect the $613 million increase to education, but it has been a priority of our caucus as long as I've been there. And I would point out, you know, the governor last time around, his education package looked different than ours did when we were done. So, you know, we will do what we can. And, you know, our members come from all over the state, have rural school districts, have urban school districts. We're going to do what we can to help out all children in education, but not accept the fact that education is always about the dollars spent. It is about results, and I think you're going to hear that discussion and that debate continue throughout this budget process.
You mentioned different districts around the state. So part of that DPI proposal includes trying to change the funding formula to relieve the gap between poorer and richer districts around the state. This has been something that lawmakers, educators have been talking about for a lot of years now. Is that an issue you're going to try to tackle in this budget?
I don't believe the funding formula is something, you know, if you accept the fact, even if you put $600 million more into the fund, and that's what the the DPI is doing, is they're basically assuring that no one loses in the funding formula, and that's kind of a little unrealistic in the real world of government. But, you know, even big districts, small districts, rural, urban, the ones I talk to say, you know what, the pie's only so big. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. We're going to look for ways to reduce the impact on the rural and the small school districts, perhaps do things more efficiently, more use of technology that's already being done in a lot of places throughout our state as a way to deal with those inequities between large communities and more rural.
So bottom line, before we move on from education, do you see any increase in the cards for schools funding?
Well, from a caucus standpoint, I mean, we'll see what the governor proposes, but from a caucus standpoint, I do believe that there's going to be a desire from many of our members to see an increase in education funding. How that materializes, what that looks like, I'm not sure, but I'm sure that desire is going to be there, but we have to live within the dollars that the taxpayers give us.
We're talking to Representative John Nygren from Marinette. He is co-chair of the state's Joint Finance Committee, and we're talking about the upcoming debate over Wisconsin's budget.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the state's spending priorities should be going forward? Do you think roads and education need more funding? And how should the state close its projected $2.2 billion deficit? Do you want to see those tax cuts coming in the next couple of years? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, Representative John Nygren from Marinette. Wisconsin's lawmakers are gearing up for a debate over the state's budget for the coming 2 years.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see as a top priority when it comes to spending or for tax cuts in this new state budget? How do you think the budget shortfall, projected at $2 billion, a little more than that, based on current department requests, how should that be tackled? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Representative Nygren, Governor Walker has been talking, including in this week's State of the State address, about consolidating government agencies. He's mentioned a couple of examples. What agencies do you think could be consolidated?
Well, we've done research in my office and asked for studies be done on consolidation in multiple state agencies over the last couple of years. You know, what the final proposal looks like, or what the government looks like after the decisions are made, really comes down to my view whether what makes sense from not only from a dollar saving standpoint, but from a services. You know, are there ways to eliminate, especially high administrative costs in our state agencies, but still maintain the services that the people of Wisconsin expect? So, you know, I don't have a dog in the fight as far as what the final proposal will look like, but I do think it's time for us to reevaluate what state government produces here in Wisconsin, the level of bureaucracy and the level of administration that the taxpayers are having to support with their hard-earned tax dollars.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Jake on the line in Milwaukee. Jake, hi. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. My question is this. how much money are you willing to borrow in this budget cycle to make Scott Walker look good?
Hmm.
Or alternately, are you willing to tank our entire system of government in Wisconsin like they have in Kansas with massive tax cuts and trickle-down economics in order to fulfill some ideological goal of destroying government?
Jake, go ahead, Representative Nygren.
Well, that sounds like it's an ideological argument that is being made there. But you know what? This is not about making any politician look good. This is about making decisions that are in the benefit of the people of the state of Wisconsin. You know, people out there may disagree with Scott Walker. They may disagree with me. They may disagree with the Republicans. But they overwhelmingly reelected the governor and the Republicans to lead the state for another 4 years. And we're going to continue on to drive the policies of putting the taxpayers first and the wishes of government second. So that's the basic principle we're going to stand for, and it's not about making anybody look good. It's about helping out the taxpayer.
Jake mentioned borrowing, and I think that was part of the formula for the transportation budget this year. Do you foresee a lot of new borrowing, new debt involved in this new budget?
Well, borrowing, bonding has always been a part of the transportation budget, at least since I've been around. I do expect to see nowhere near the reliance on bonding that we had in the last budget, but I do believe it's going to continue to be a part of the budget. As a matter of fact, it has made sense over the last, even going back to Governor Doyle, who relied heavily on bonding, because you're utilizing borrowing at a time when rates are very low, and you're funding projects that have a 30-year or longer life expectancy. So rather than expecting the taxpayers of today to completely pay for something that people 30 years are going to be using, I'm not sure that makes sense. So there will be some, but it is our goal as a caucus to reduce the level of borrowing in this budget.
We'll go now to Brent in Shattuck. Brent, hi.
Hi. I was also wondering about the cuts to education or possible cuts to education. He said something about other states having this problem of being short on their budget. And I was just wondering what other states have cut as much in our education as we have in the state of Wisconsin.
Brent, thanks for the call. Representative Nygren, any compare and contrast with other states on education funding?
Well, I would just say that, there's been a PolitiFact done on the fact that Wisconsin had the largest cut to education ever. And I think that $1 billion number that you're actually throwing around has been called either false or pants on fire. So I would just suggest that number is not accurate. In fact, in our last budget, we put $300 million more into education than the previous cycle. Yes, under Act 10, the way my wife is a public school teacher, I have two kids in the public school system. We did expect our teachers and our government and state employees to pay more for their pension and their health care, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's being fewer dollars spent in the classroom. I would suggest, as I said earlier, there's more dollars spent in the classroom. But if you actually compare Wisconsin to other states, on a per pupil spending, we are one of the highest in the Midwest and in the nation.
Moving up to higher education, your colleague, Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, has said related to the UW system budget, he wants professors to spend more time in classrooms and to focus research more on projects with direct economic benefits to the state. Your thoughts on that issue?
Well, I think anybody would agree for the most part that if you have a state salary or a government-funded salary, that we should be getting a return on investment for our dollars, whether that means more time in the classroom, whether it be bringing in research that's going to help us grow our economy, put more people back to work. We should find ways to utilize those folks as best we possibly can. So I support what the speaker has said, but I don't know that it can be imposed on a unilateral situation. I think the conversations I've had with President Cross and others at UW-Madison, we are looking for ways to reform how we and what we expect from our employees, but not necessarily do a blanket statement moving forward.
Just a quick glance at PolitiFact. A quote, they said, in February 2012, we rated true a broader claim that Governor Walker had enacted the biggest cuts to education in our state's history. What's the difference between the one you had said was untrue or pants on fire?
Well, I don't have the access to the internet like you do, but I'll tell you what, when we're done with this phone call, I'll send it to you.
Well, let's talk about timing of this budget, and that's been an issue Governor Walker had said at various points, that he wanted this one to be done quickly. He's backed off on that a little, though he's going to make his budget address a little earlier than is typical. Your thoughts on the timing and how quick you're going to turn this around?
You know, we have a job to do in the state legislature. I have 63 Republicans in the assembly. We have 33 Democrats. Everybody deserves the right. They're elected to the same level of responsibility. Everybody has an opportunity, should have an opportunity to review the budget, have some input on it. We go through our statewide tour where we get input from the public. I do not believe that we are going to shortchange the process that has been longstanding here in Wisconsin. If you can introduce it a few weeks early, I believe we can probably get done a few weeks early, but we are not going to sacrifice the process just for a sped up timeline.
And briefly, the budget obviously is going to take a lot of your attention. School accountability has been the big issue so far in the assembly. Any other big non-budget items that you're hoping to get to early in this session?
Well, you already mentioned school accountability. I mean, there's a lot of discussion going on about GAB reform. I had an audit committee hearing yesterday dealing with the shortcomings that have been found at the Government Accountability Board. I think that's going to be a discussion as we move throughout the session. I think you're going to be hearing more in my office. We're probably going to be working on some corrections reform, continue focus on opiate problems here we have in our state. You know, the way we focused last session, it was about solving problems, and I think that it's going to continue to be the direction of our caucus and of the Republican majorities in both houses.
A lot to keep you busy. Representative Nygren, thanks a lot for spending the time with us.
You're welcome. Have a good afternoon.
That was John Nygren. He's co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee and a representative from Marinette, talking about the upcoming debate over Wisconsin's budget.